The Thing, and Nova. Welcome to FW Team Up, a proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm Siskoid.
And I'm Ryan Daly.
Taking you through a classic superhero team up, the next in the Cosmic Heroes order, The Thing and the Man Called Nova from Marvel 2-in-1 Annual number 3, cover dated 1978. And Ryan, though this is a Marvel comic, I think DC fans might have a case of déjà vu in this.
You think so? You think there are a lot of DC type of tropes and things in this one?
I think that writer Marv Wolfman brought baggage with him when he moved house.
Perhaps, yeah.
You'll recognize it when you hear it. Okay, so let's preface with a reason or reasons why we like this guest character. What's so great about Nova?
He's visually fun to look at. I'm not sure there's much more to it than that. And I've tried to read a lot of Nova, but I think it's part of it is just the dynamics of his power set. And, you know, he's constantly in motion, sort of like a speedster, like the Flash or something like that. You know, if you're drawing Nova, he should always be in flight. And as we see constantly, just, you know, sort of like the torso and arms and then just like trailing lines for like motion and movement. It's not like the way Superman flies or a winged character flies. He is like a cannonball, you know, just being like propelled forward. Pretty sure the first time I saw this character, I think, was in the 1993 Marvel Universe trading card series by Impel. And that was my introduction to a lot of characters who weren't in the X-Men or Spider-Man families. But his card was unique, and it might have been by Eric Larson. I can't think of the artist who did it.
Oh, wow.
Maybe that sounds kind of right. But it was different because instead of like kind of the more classical hero shot showing the full body, his was like coming straight at you, like indirectly, with his fist out. And his fist was huge, like bigger than his head, like, you know, kind of giving you that like that point of view, that image. So it was an interesting card that didn't look like the other cards. So that kind of kept him in mind. And then the first time I read about him was like in New Warriors issue 6. And that was when he had the brown costume that I did not care for at the time. But
yeah.
And then during the 90s, I read more New Warriors. And he guest starred in Spider-Man a couple of times around that era too. So didn't think much about him again until the Annihilation series, where he really stepped up and revealed how cool he could be. Although in hindsight, the whole thing about him in Annihilation seems very similar to the Green Lantern riff with Kyle Rayner, which, again, another familiar Marvel DC thing crossing over.
Nova means very little to me. You know, I first encountered him in the original Marvel Universe, Book of the Dead. He was an inactive hero at the time, but he had like a really cool costume, and that's really all that was, you know, that's still to me the best thing about him.
Yeah, I mean, it's like I said, he's cool to look at.
All right, let's talk a bit about his publication history. The character was actually created in 1966 by Marv Wolfman in issue 3 of his fanzine, Super Adventures. He was then known as The Star. He was an alien doctor who found a spaceship containing pills, which gave him different superhuman powers every 5 minutes. In issue 6, Wolfman and Len Wein reimagined the character, now a prisoner who becomes the superhero Black Nova. And years later, Wolfman and John Romita Sr. tweaked the character's uniform and gave him a new identity and origin. So Nova made his Marvel Comics debut in The Man Called Nova, number 1. That's cover dated September of 1976. The intention was to make him a teenage character in the style of Spider-Man. But the way Richard Rider is chosen by a dying alien to take on the responsibilities of an interstellar police force really rather recalls Green Lantern. That's very much the template. Anyway, the original series lasted 25 issues. This team up that we cover today takes place between issues 21 and 22, so towards the end, which would be in 1979. Wolfman resolved dangling plot threads in Fantastic Four 206 to 214 and ROM 24, and then Nova retired. He didn't want to be stuck in space, he missed his family, but he returned to action with the introduction of the New Warriors in 1989's Mighty Thor number 411, and that's where I hand it off to you, Mr. 90s.
Blasting away from his appearance in the Mighty Thor issues of the Acts of Vengeance crossover, Nova re-exploded onto the scene in 1990 as part of the New Warriors team in their self-titled comic book. Briefly rebranded as Kid Nova, the character was a mainstay in the New Warriors throughout the book's 75-issue run until it was canceled in 1996. During the same time, a second self-titled Nova series ran for just 18 issues in 1994-95, but just like its predecessor, it ended on a cliffhanger with loose threads to be picked up in other comics. As part of the New Warriors and as one of Marvel's more powerful cosmic heroes, Nova made guest appearances and cameos in countless comics during the early 90s, many tying into the Infinity Gauntlet, Infinity War, and Infinity Crusade crossover events. In 1999, Nova starred in his third solo comic, Nova the Human Rocket, which only lasted 7 issues. He also returned for subsequent reboots of the New Warriors in the early 2000s. After years of misuse and neglect, Richard Rider finally hit the big time in 2006, starring in the 4-issue miniseries Annihilation Nova, where the Nova Corps was wiped out, leaving him the last living and most powerful Nova in the universe. He then returned as the central hero of the Annihilation miniseries event. After that, Marvel launched another Nova ongoing series alongside the Annihilation sequel, Conquest. And since then, Nova has been a stalwart part of every cosmic event or series, including many reboots of the Guardians of the Galaxy comic. For a time, the Richard Rider character was thought dead and replaced by a new teenage Nova named Sam Alexander. Alexander eventually helped Richard Rider return to the pages of his own comic. Rider is currently, to the best of my knowledge, part of the Guardians of the Galaxy.
You're right that there's a big Kyle Rayner riff in that. You know, let's destroy the core.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And I'm going to project into the future. In March 2022, Marvel Studios revealed it was developing a project featuring Richard Rider, Nova, as a special presentation released on Disney Plus. So like Werewolf by Night, I suppose.
Yeah, it could be, yeah.
I don't know. So they're working on this. We'll see if it eventually turns up. We're just going to do a very short synopsis of this issue and then get into the weeds of it. It's called When Strike the Monitors. It's written by Marv Wolfman, art by Sal Buscema, Frank Giacoya, and Dave Hunt. Giant aliens called the Monitors come to Earth to judge its worthiness against an impossible standard, and inevitably choose to destroy it. But Nova, the Thing, and 3 powerful sisters enslaved by the Monitors to power their ships defeat 2 of them before the 3rd, responsible for one of the sisters' release, surrenders, weary of his race's mission. All the aliens leave to try and convince the rest of the Monitors to stop their destructive swath across the universe.
What's this now? Some monitors judging planets and on their worthiness and then destroying them?
Yes, the girls kind of look like could be Harbinger. Yeah. Marv Wolfman would bring the Monitor to his Teen Titan comics, and then, you know, that would spin out into Crisis on Infinite Earths. But if you're a comic book historian, you want to pick up this issue. You want to find out, you know, just where the seeds of these ideas came from.
Would we call this a beta test? You know?
Right. There's an awful lot of imagery where there's like an Earth you can sort of bounce around in your hand. You know, the imagery is even the same. Let's go through it. What about that cover?
I like the cover enough. To me, it feels very reminiscent of a Fantastic Four cover of around this at this time, this era. We see at least 2 of the Monitors, one kind of hulking large, holding up this blonde-haired woman, which you can kind of interpret as like the giant monster holding up Sue Storm. Another, we only see its foot in the foreground, but its foot is large enough to be stepping on the Thing. And then we have this other, we have our guest star, Nova, basically is the surrogate. Johnny Storm, in this case, just flying around. The only thing it's really missing is Reed Richards. It's a little bit word-heavy with so much text at the top with the name and the king-size annual of it all and the different guest stars, and then everybody has some dialogue on this. So it's a little bit wordy and it's a little bit busy, but at least the art and the imagery reminds me of a Fantastic Four cover, so I like it.
That's a good observation. I think even Reed Richards is sort of represented in the streaking.
Yeah, actually,
of Nova's.
Yeah,
you know, Nova's tail sort of creates these swoops that you might, you know, associate with if you take your glasses off.
With the elongation of Reed. Yeah, okay.
I think the best part of it is the Thing under the foot. like the giant foot and the thing under. That's really what pops. And that's also where all that text goes away. So it remains like the clearest part of the image. Splash page, and already we're in Nova's world. We get a lot of backstory as if this were an issue of Nova. That's what it felt like to me.
And I like this opening page, and again, like just like the visualization of Richard's power and showing how like the bot back half just becomes streaks of light. He moves that fast. He's that propulsive. It's cool. We get the kind of the shadow of his head in the background to sort of see what his face and his helmet looks like, and that's a cool design. The cityscape looks nice. You see like everybody kind of reacting to him in the street. Everybody's kind of like in shock, and yeah, it's a cool first image.
It's a bird. It's a plane. It's Nova. And he gets into a little action just trying to introduce him to readers who don't necessarily read the man called Nova. He's on his second year, but maybe this isn't like a best-selling title. You know, it's about to be canceled, actually. You know, we get a lot more backstory, and Nova has to do a little action even before we get into the plot. Or you could call this padding for king-sized annuals that have a lot more pages. He saves a guy, you know, a construction worker from falling off a building. So what do you think of this sequence?
It's a little bit silly. I do like, I mean, from the first page, we don't know exactly how old this character is, but he talks about his dad being on bail, and he talks about his friends as if they're like a major part of his life. So we can assume that he's a young character. We don't know exactly if he's like high school or college or something like that. But from this beginning, like, the guy falls off the construction scaffolding because of Nova. It's his recklessness, his carelessness, that he has to go and save this guy. So we do see he's a young hero who still has a lot to learn.
Right.
But then the actual machinations of how he saves this guy who's falling, he doesn't fly and catch him. Instead, he flies to a nearby building with a awning, rips the awning off, ties the awning as if to like create like a hammock on the side of the building, and catches not only the falling worker, but a bunch of wrought iron girders all in the same kind of tarp net like awning thing. Like, you'd think that they would just fall on top of this guy and he would still be crushed, but it's one of those things. And there's another example of this on the very next page where he's like, this superheroic act is way too much. And it's like, no. It's keep it simple, stupid. That KISS philosophy.
He is young and he's making mistakes and he's not doing the obvious thing. He lacks experience. I'm hoping that that's what Marv Wolfman is getting at, and that the series was a lot like this. Because otherwise, it's the writer doing it, you know? So I agree. This is a very weird sequence, and it probably may turn up when we talk about weird moves.
Yeah.
There's a lot of this.
On the next page, there's a woman, an elderly woman, crossing the street, and a car is bearing down on her. What would a flying superhero do in such a case? Possibly lift the woman out of danger? No, he lifts the entire car. It's like, okay, showing off a little, but yeah.
And he's not even sure he can do it. It's like, I pray I can lift it, even for a moment.
It's like, maybe go for the easier target then.
And at the same time that this is happening, there's a bright light in the sky, and a leg comes out of it, of the light, and there's a giant alien there. This is our first shot of, well, not the monitor, a monitor.
Not the monitor that DC fans know and love. Yeah. I do kind of like this design as just a generic alien type of creature. The costume is okay. You could use this design for really anything. It wouldn't have to be like a celestial judge, but you know, give this guy like a weapon, make him any kind of like just typical like a sort of like a Badoon soldier or some kind of like alien trooper or something. It's like, it's a good design. But I like this page 4, just like for everything else, like just the facial expressions that Buscema draws of like the man on the street as they're running in terror away from this sudden appearance of the giant. I like the crowd reaction and everything. Yeah, that's a fun one.
Yeah, the guy running towards us. I at first I thought, oh, is this supposed to be Marv Wolfman or something? You know, sometimes Marvel Comics did this a lot.
Yeah.
Putting in the writers and artists, you know, in crowd scenes. But I've never seen a picture of him in the 70s where he had long hair like that. But otherwise, maybe. Could be anyone in the Marvel bullpen. So by this point, Nova, who's just come back from space and et cetera, it must be thinking, like, he has that Parker luck. Oh, I fly around and I make a guy fall, and he's making all the wrong moves. And immediately, you know, there's an alien invasion, and he'll have trouble finding help against this even though New York is supposed to be full of superheroes. I think he sees himself as a bit of a jinx. You know, earlier he calls himself a Jonah, you know, from the Bible. They throw Jonah off the boat because he's an ill omen and, you know, he gets eaten by a whale and someone with that brings bad luck.
I had that in my notes. I wasn't sure about that reference, yeah.
Well, he can't fight this giant alien. He tries, but he gets shot by I-beams. So he races to the Avengers, and the Avengers aren't there.
We do get a nice little Jarvis cameo.
If only Jarvis could help.
Right.
So he goes to the Baxter building, even though he's read something about the FF breaking up. I don't know what the storyline is. At this point, Marv Wolfman is also writing the FF, and we're around issue 200.
They had broken up just before that. I think 200 is where they got back together. But they were broken up for the issues leading up to that.
There's a big Doctor Doom storyline going on. So he gets to the Baxter building, and it's full of traps.
Of course.
You know, so it's not going well. And the only person there is the Thing. We kind of knew that's going
to
happen.
And, of course, to basically expedite, like, the typical Marvel team-up where you have to fight first, Nova's like, hey, you don't know me, but I am a hero. Look, I've got all of these press clippings of my own. Look, I keep all of my press in my wallet. Like, look, like, these are all these articles. And Thing kind of peruses them. He's like, okay, I guess your story works out. Like, yeah, I believe you now. Okay, then we can team up. And it's like, we don't have to fight. Just trust me. I like that.
There's just one swing towards them. And that's the Marvel fight that, you know, that's usually going to happen.
Yeah. Like, okay, like, this kid, really, do you, like, keep, like, newspaper clippings with all of your accolades and your heroic adventures, like, on you all the time? But it's like, well, at a time like this, it's not that crazy because he uses it to his advantage.
We get into chapter 2, now that they've teamed up. The mystery unfolds. All right. And, of course, we've got a giant alien that's drilling some type of technology into the Earth to test it. Doing that pH test.
And for Ben, this is a regular Wednesday.
Yes, because this is Galactus. Like, he calls it something like, you know, who's this Galactus reject? Earlier, Nova had mentioned, referenced Godzilla instead. And you do get some kaiju action later. The action moves to Tokyo. So.
Right.
There's this reference. There's a reference to Star Wars later. Nova is where he likes movies. Sadly, if he's a Godzilla fan, the new Godzilla movie? This is 1978. In 1975... there was the last of the Showa era Godzillas. So Terror of Mechagodzilla was the last one. It's 1978. Nova's not going to get a new Godzilla movie until 1984. So pretty sad for a Godzilla fan at this moment. But maybe, I mean, Godzilla and Star Wars are both comics published by Marvel.
That's right.
Marv Wolfman is throwing a bone at Archie Goodwin, who's a writer-editor on those things. So,
just like Ben Grimm, Godzilla only needs a long trench coat and a fedora to disguise himself.
We get into this action, and while they fight, stuff is happening aboard the alien ship. Because there's a woman inside a tube, and she escapes by throwing I-beams and melting her pod, walking out. Teleporting down, and now she's part of the action as well. And she's gigantic, like she's twice as tall as the Thing. Now, I like this effect, the way they teleport, those squiggly lines.
Yeah, sort of as if like she's like coming apart at like an atomic level or something like that.
Yeah,
like,
I think that's a cool way to do it.
Yeah.
Well, she's going to be the person who explains the mission, basically, what's happening. She says, well, the monitors, this is what the monitors do. They go around, they judge planets, and then they blow them up if they don't show true perfection. There are three ships, three monitors that are at Earth right now, and she needs to rescue her sisters, who are similar giant women, and so cut off the power. They're being used to power these ships by whatever cosmic powers that they have themselves. And so they're going to go and first to, is it Paris?
Yeah.
So they're going to go around the world and rescue these women. But of course, the monitors are not going to... There's a lot of action. You know, the monitors aren't going to let this happen if they can help it. Nova is zapped. This is pretty weird. Nova gets zapped into space. He doesn't even know where he is. He gets sent to a place where a star is going Nova. So his namesake.
Mm-hmm.
And he has to race away from a star exploding in such a way as to, like, he breaks the light speed barrier.
It's a confusing scene that's like, where does this come from? Did you just have an extra page to fill?
Yeah, it's like a side mission where in chapter three, we'll track back, but in chapter three, he has to return. He goes too fast. He becomes spaghettified, if I'm using physics right.
Yeah, essentially, yeah.
You know, so he's in a space warp. And he's holding the Earth in his hand. So this is like a weird space that, again, reminds us of Crisis on Infinite Earths. And he's flying on loose electrons and such. And when he reaches Earth, he snaps back and he's back into the action. But that happens only in Chapter 3. In Chapter 2, if we're still there, they do release the other woman. And the thing is still going up against monitors. He's still being thrown back. It gets thrown back so far, not as far as Nova, but that he has to, you know, remote control, get the Fantasticar to catch him. And then he's back into the action. To keep this going, heroes are repulsed.
Yeah, there's a lot of that. It kind of seems like Wolfman establishes the threat of the monitors very clearly. But then as soon as Melandra shows up, which is just a few pages later, she's like, oh, there's an easy fix for this. You just need to rescue my sisters. And it's like, okay, how do we stop these heroes from rescuing them? It's like, okay, just throw them all, like, just throw them away. Just throw them on different sides of the universe or something.
And the thing doesn't really trust them to do this or anything, but he's also a bit out of his depth, you know, always going up again, these cosmic giants with just his fists. But that's Ben Grimm. We've seen it before on this show. You know, Ben Grimm doesn't give up and doesn't care if a supervillain is overpowered. He just keeps going. And here we get, okay, like, so chapter three begins. As Tokyo goes, so goes the world. So we're going to get some Tokyo action, which makes sense for the giants. And we get more backstory as the sisters tell of the true origin of the monitors. They've got this King Suzerain, which I think is a ridiculous name because a suzerain is also a king, so it's King. And how they, you know, their culture reached a pinnacle and then they decided, we reach perfection and we must make sure others strive towards this perfection or else, you know, they're going to be trouble or threaten our order. And so they went around and destroyed a lot of planets that didn't meet with their standards, which is most or all, as they became more distanced from their own humanity, I guess, you know, knowing right from wrong, they became obsessed with this mission. The sisters are adamant that this must now stop. Nova returns from space. We get three panels of his supporting cast for no reason. Okay.
Yeah.
That doesn't have any incidents on the story. I don't know why we see them all of a sudden, but they're there. And the battle is joined once again, as the two freed sisters try to free the third one.
There's a lot going on. It's like, there's probably enough in this chapter for a regular book. The casting him out into space, like the weird sort of warpage where he has to, yeah, he's like, his whole body turns into spaghetti, as you said, in order to get back. Like, and the fact that power is never used again by the monitors, like, which they couldn't, but I don't know. There's some good action with, you know, Ben, like, lifting up the tree from the trunk and everything and hurling himself. Ben burning his foot, which is kind of ridiculous when Nova has to catch him. And he's like, oh, this is how mortifying. He's like, yeah, actually Nova calls him ridiculous for burning his foot on it. Good action, but kind of like, it feels like the story's getting away from us.
And this is also the, at the end of this chapter, we find out the sisters are actually robots.
Right, which we needed that twist.
Machines who evolved here's how she says it, as endless cries assailed us, as planets erupted in the throes of destruction, our mechanical forms became receptacles for those billions of souls. So they are somehow inhabited by the souls of the monitor's victims. And that's why they're goodies, and that's why
they want to stop this whole thing, yeah.
That makes sense. Oh, but that makes sense. Up to a point. Because we see one of the sisters get essentially destroyed, but by chapter four, she's fine.
Right.
So they fix her up real quick. In chapter four, Wrath of the Monitors. Okay, wholesale destruction of Tokyo.
Another good opening image, like the good, like a full page splash of like the monitors destroying everything, just laying waste and people running for their lives in terror. It's another good full page spread.
Yeah, it's kind of silly in a way that these cosmic villains who show up, and they're very much like Galactus, just standing there, doing their thing, ignoring everything, are actually just like, all right, let's just destroy this town for fun. You know, let's just rip buildings apart. Okay.
Yeah.
And that's one of the things about these annuals. You know, you can start each chapter with a right. big image, and you can spend time on splash pages because you got so many pages to play with.
Yeah. Then one of my favorite parts in the whole story, Nova is attacking the monitor. It blasts him with its eye beams again. Doesn't shoot him out into space, but does shoot him over Mount Fuji, the volcano. And we just see him vanishing into the distance over three panels. And when he's out of sight, you just hear him say, "Hey," and we eventually learn he says that because he comes up with an idea. Like, that's his sort of, like, light bulb moment where he's like, "Hey, wait a minute, I figured out how to fight you guys." It's just kind of like this ridiculous moment.
There's some action then that I want to keep for my moves later, so I won't mention them here. But the thing is, of course, still trying to help civilians and trying to help Tokyo here. Nova's light bulb moment, right? He draws a monitor to the volcano and pushes him in.
Just very, very simple, like as low tech a plan as you could get. Just like lure him to the edge of the cliff and then push him.
Yeah, I can see that working. You know, lava is pretty hot. But the thing's answer to this, like the thing falls through the floor and into the subway system, and the other monitor just gets hit by a subway car. Does that really? Is that enough to vaporize this guy? It seems like a volcano, a subway car, a big difference. But that leaves only one monitor, and that monitor like talks to the sisters, and he's the one who freed the first sister, and he's sick of it as well. And he thinks this is like the wrong course for his culture, and they all leave together.
I think he just saw which way the wind was blowing, and he's like, all right, my brothers are getting killed. Like, this, I've clearly bit off more than I can chew on this planet. You know, I never even liked this plan. It's like, I've always thought we were going about it the wrong way.
Well, he does say he released the sister, the first sister. So, okay, maybe that was his plan all along, but they do restore Tokyo before they leave with their cosmic powers.
Right.
You know, next shot, people are walking down the street like it never happened. Crisis style.
Yeah.
And then they leave.
Yeah.
This ending. I find it so weird when writers tell on themselves.
Yeah.
Because in this case, thing goes, I don't believe it. It's so. And then Nova says, anticlimactic? And the thing is like, no, frustrating, but you know.
Yeah.
I didn't even get a chance to yell, it's clobbering time. You had plenty of opportunities, Ben. But yeah, it is an anticlimax. Suddenly, it's the three robot sisters who are the heroes, and they're the ones who fix everything. And I guess they do, you know, kill off a couple of monitors. The very ending is just, well, we ran out of pages.
And then, you know, Harbinger or whatever just says, deuces, we're out of here.
Big battle, high stakes. But ultimately, I think the villains were a bit thin, and the heroes are incidental to the actual climax, or the actual ending.
In this team-up, could anybody have filled in and helped out these sisters, yeah?
Right. Where's Sunfire when this is going on? I guess 1978, he's stuck with the X-Men. No, he's just with the X-Men like one issue. So no, he should have been there, you know, playing Human Torch to this. Oh well. Then who fared better? As usual, how well does this fit each of their stories or atmospheres? Is this a Thing story or is it more of a Nova story? Because to me, this felt like an issue of Nova. You know, like Marv Wolfman is just like writing a bonus issue of his own book. He's recapping recent events that don't have a bearing on this story. There's a half page devoted to the supporting cast who don't otherwise figure. So I feel like this almost could have been in the Nova series itself.
I completely agree. Yeah, I mean, from the first page, this looks like an issue of Nova to me. Like, it's his story, his kind of coming back and kind of discovering the crisis, him reaching out for a hero. And had one of the Avengers been around, had he found Iron Man or Captain America or Hawkeye or something, he never would have gone to the Baxter Building, and this wouldn't have been a Marvel 2-in-1. It just sort of happens that the Thing is there and lucks into it, but the Thing doesn't really feel like he's central to the conflict or the resolution. How much Nova is also questionable. But yeah, the fact that we learn more about Nova and his story and his like contemporaries and his supporting characters in the story, and we don't really see anything of Ben's. Yeah, it does feel like a Nova story.
There we go. What about cool moves? What is the thing's coolest move?
After the monitor shoots Ben with his blast from his eyes, I like, or when he's actually holding onto it, Ben tries to shoo Nova away from pulling the monitor's fingers apart from him, like, enough that he can escape. And I like that moment, like, where Ben was basically saying, forget about me, save the world, focus, I got this, I'm okay. And it just seemed like one of those things where, yeah, Ben, he's in a tough spot. He could use a hand, but he's never going to want to admit that. And he's also going to want to say, prioritize, do the more important thing than save me.
I like that you went for the heart.
Yeah, again, that's just Ben.
I like the bit where he sees a woman and her child in Tokyo about to be crushed by a monitor, and he slams his fist down, and the shockwave is enough to send them flying.
That's nice, yeah. That's
hopefully
a good one
harmlessly,
too.
You know, out of the path of the giant foot. What about Nova?
I mean, I guess it has to be the part where he just, like, lures the monitor towards Mount Fuji, where he just, like, he flies, but he's like, okay, I gotta fly fast enough that I'm out of his grip, but, like, not so fast that he loses me, because I need him to keep coming, and once he gets him to the edge of the volcano, then spins around and gets him in the back. I guess just because it seems like such a simple plan, but it's effective, so, yeah, all right, good job, man.
For me, it's the spaghettification of Nova. That's the bit I'm going to remember most after this. You know, he's racing from a nova, from a supernova or something. He's flying on free electrons. He warps himself out of shape. It's not necessary to the story. It feels very much like little parentheses, like you said. Like, it's padding, but it is memorable padding. What about weird moves? What do you think is the things?
When the thing, like, tries to attack the monitor ship with a tree, like, it lashes out and it shoots, like, these heat beams from its foot and, like, just burns the grass underfoot, and Ben is kind of, like, hopping up off the ground, like, he's like, yow, the creep gave me a blasted hot foot, and Nova has to, like, pick him up to keep him off the ground. He's like, how embarrassing, how humiliating, how mortifying. So, yeah, just kind of silly that, yeah, he burned the thing's foot.
You'd think the thing would be
sensorily impervious to heat and cold like that,
right?
The fact that he doesn't have clothing, you know?
I don't know. For me, well, okay, let's go back to that Tokyo scene where he saves the bystanders. And then the next bit that doesn't work for me is when he rips a lamppost out of the ground and tries to electrocute the monitor with it. But the electricity doesn't come from the lamppost, does it? Those cables should be dead. The actual cables that are electrified are in the ground.
Are in the ground, yeah.
So, okay, so that one, I don't believe it for a second. In terms of Nova, I mean, we've talked a lot about his weird moves at the beginning or his dumb moves. So I don't believe for a second that catching that falling construction worker and at least three steel beams in the same tarp wouldn't kill that guy, or not rip through the tarp, you know, anything like that. I don't.
It's like, dude, just fly down and grab the guy. And mine is the same thing that we talked about on the very next page when the car is bearing down on the elderly woman. Pick her up. Don't try and pick up the car if you don't know if you can.
All right. What about the unfriendly farewell? It's Ben's team-up tradition, but in this case, can we call it a goodbye? I guess the heroes and the aliens, the alien sisters who are the co-heroes here, do part. But there isn't a goodbye between our two guys.
No, they're just left there kind of on the same page. Like, is that it? That's all we got? Okay.
I mean, it's a downbeat.
It's unsatisfying, but unsatisfactory. But.
All right, we'll take a break for a couple promos, and we'll be back with our special features.
Afternoon, everybody.
Ryan!
How's that baby treating you, Mr. Daly?
Like Thanos snapping his fingers at my bank account.
In that case, how about a beer on the house?
Sure, gotta give my mouth something to do between podcasts.
Say, Ryan, I don't get how you have so much time for podcasting. Doesn't your wife want you spending time with the baby?
Would you? Truth is, I think she's a little worried about how much time I'm spending with the kid, ever since his first words were Dagobah system. Now she wants me to go out and do something mature, something productive, and most of all, something lucrative that can support the family.
So you're going to...
podcast about Cheers, yeah. That kid's not going to start college for 18 years. I got time. Cheerscast, the podcast where everybody knows your name. Coming soon to the Fire and Water Network.
Thank you.
Coming soon from Amalgam Comics. Richard Curry is just a normal high school student until he receives a strange Atlantean helmet in the mail. From then on, he is Aqua Nova, the Aqua Corps' chosen champion on the surface world. But why him? Is it all a big mistake? Are his parents keeping secrets? And just how is he supposed to use the helmet's powers over sea life on the streets? Get on board early with the first wetsuited issue, This Sep Never, only from Amalgam Comics. We're back, and our monthly feature is the bonus team-up, in which each of us proposes, in this case, a perfect Nova team-up. What do you got?
Well, because we talked so much in the beginning about how the Nova character, and he is very similar in type to Green Lantern, with being part of an interstellar police force, a corps as it is, the way Nova, Richard Rider's greatest moment, is basically when the rest of the corps is wiped out. It's very similar to what happened with Kyle Rayner and the Green Lantern Corps in the 90s. So, keeping with the same idea of Nova being the Green Lantern of the Marvel Universe, I thought let's team him up with the Green Arrow of the Marvel Universe, and that is the Avenging Archer Hawkeye. So the two of them would team up as the hard-traveling heroes of Marvel.
Clever.
And I guess they would fight cult leaders and drug dealers and stuff that is way beyond Nova's power set, but or way below Nova's power set, I mean.
Yes, but he'd learn important lessons about the social order.
Exactly.
For me, well, I was thinking Nova teams up with his precursors from Wolfman's fanzine, which is to say Star and Black Nova. So this is published in a universe where his lawsuit against Marvel to retain the rights of both Nova and Blade worked out in his favor, and he's allowed to use Nova in personal projects. Maybe the Monitors can return to threaten their three Earths or something.
That would be fun. I wanna
rock! As usual, we're riffing on Ryan's deep interest in music to bring you his musical selection to go with the comic and its guest star. So, Ryan, what are we listening to while we read this comic?
So, as much as I kind of, in my mind, I think of Nova as a 90s hero, I wanted to be true to this story and be, I try to be more contemporary with music selections. And okay. This one coming out in the late 70s, I was like, okay, what would the cosmic hero be? Like, what would his soundtrack be? So, I went with something, I tried to look for something in the space rock genre, or like more psychedelic, you know, prog rock or something, and found a deep cut from the Jimi Hendrix album Are You Experienced, but the song is Third Stone from the Sun. And if you listen to it, it's almost 7 minutes long. It's mostly an instrumental with lots of different guitar parts and different guitar riffs. But the occasional smattering of vocals are more like spoken word poetry or monologues that like take on like the personifications of like a character of like interstellar travelers observing Earth and making commentary on it. And so like there's just this whole otherworldly visitor vibe from that, and it reminded me of this issue.
I enjoyed it because the selection is something you can listen as a soundtrack to while you're reading, or as something that is more lyric based. Well, you sort of had to take a break and then listen to this. You know, you can't read while also listening to the words
right
as easily. So in this case, it's more of a soundscape, you know, going on, and like the weird voices in it could be these monitors, murmuring or, you know, something. Nice selection. It's the spaghettification of Jimi Hendrix. Okay, now it's time for feedback on our previous episode together, in which we covered Marvel 2-in-1 number 5, starring The Thing and the Guardians of the Galaxy.
We got a comment from James Williams, who said, I first encountered the Guardians of the Galaxy in The Avengers during the Korvac saga, and really liked the characters, so I thoroughly enjoyed this episode. Poor Ryan sounded terrible. I hope he feels better soon. You know, I'm actually congested with a little bit of a cold as we speak, but yeah, back when we did that, I was near death. I've read very few Blackhawk comic books, but my understanding is that each pilot is from a different country, and that each of these countries had been taken over during World War II. That is correct.
Yep.
Each member of the Guardians of the Galaxy is from a different planet that had been taken over or destroyed by the Badoon. I really wonder if when Arnold Drake and Gene Colan created the Guardians, they were intentionally making a science fiction twist on the Blackhawks. Whether they were trying to or not, that's interesting. I've always thought that there's a lot that you could do with a more futuristic or space-based science fiction take on the Blackhawks. I know the New 52 tried something like that, and then it really seemed like they didn't know what they were doing or they aborted that. But I've always thought that you could do a kind of X-Wing Rogue Squadron version of the Blackhawks in space as, like, starfighter pilots or something.
The Blackhawks from the New 52 were... It was G.I. Joe.
It was, yeah. It was, yeah.
All right, Bucky 749 says, well, he gives us his team-up for the Guardians. When the Guardians' ship gets hit by a strange force, they are teleported to the command center of what's left of it. After finding several historic documents written by a young man named Billy, they find out about the Power Rangers and their last stand. Using the morphing grid, the Guardians are able to travel back in time to team up with the Rangers to stop an unknown foe. After the adventure, Zordan creates a new suit, and Vance Astro becomes the alternate timeline White Tiger Ranger. I read that without really knowing what I was reading, to be honest. I never got into Power Rangers. It's just not...
I recognized a few of the nouns, but yeah. That's a good idea. That's fun.
Yeah.
Brian Schufaux. Until today, the extent of my knowledge of the Guardians of the Galaxy, excluding the movies, was limited to the Amalgam Universe's mashup with the Legion of Superheroes. I would never have guessed any of these four members were meant to be the main characters. The point mentioned where there needs to be at least one present-day human character whose face we can see for the readers to identify is a great observation.
Thank you. Chris Pine, not that Chris Pine, says, first off, 1974, Earth, distant past. I was born in 1974. Go screw yourself. well, you know, that scaling timeline, right? I enjoyed hearing the Guardians of the Galaxy publication history because I think I assumed that this version of the team had a decent run for Marvel in the late 60s and was surprised how limited their appearances seemed to be. I also enjoyed the music tie-in, and I'm looking forward to checking out the Fire and Water Records podcast in the future. You'll be glad you did.
Thank you. Our fellow network member Paul Keane said, great episode as usual. I never got into Guardians of the Galaxy as a kid, and while I have enjoyed the movies, I don't really feel much of a connection to any of the characters, new or old. But I happened to reread the early Marvel 2-in-1 issues a couple of years ago, and really got a kick out of all of the Gerber issues. Just wacky fights followed by tons of exposition, as you pointed out.
Well, those plots need to be explained. Ward Hill Terry is disappointed that we fell so easily into the DC versus Marvel comparison, first because it's almost always an inaccurate comparison in that there was no DC style across the company's titles, and Marvel's were all edited by Stan for a very long time. And secondly, because the point you agreed on, the optimistic future at DC, was also inaccurate. The comic was contemporaneous with OMAC being released. Commandy, the last boy on Earth, had been on the stands for almost 2 years, during which time the Legion of Superheroes was barely surviving. Hercules, another DC title about a dystopian future, would soon be on the stands as well. What you were attributing to Marvel as a whole should more accurately be attributed to Steve Gerber. His writing in the mid-70s was quite misanthropic. His pessimism about the future and present of mankind seemed to be an extrapolation of the worst parts of contemporary American culture and seeing no hope. He didn't seem to acknowledge what any other nations or cultures on Earth were doing. He was misanthropic and myopic. Gerber was a true original writer in comics, and I believe he was probably single-handedly responsible for the Guardians' appearances in this title. I wouldn't be surprised to learn that he may have had a hand in their redesign as well. Ryan was quite accurate that their initial appearance, they were monochromatic. When you mentioned that Vance Astro stated his birth date as 1962, it made perfect sense that he would be our guide character. Many readers picking up the book in 1974 would also have been born in 1962. Yeah, the Great Disaster, right, was contemporaneous with, I mean, in the timeline, I would say it was contemporaneous with Marvel 2099, right? It's like 100 years in the future, maybe. But 1,000 years in the future, that's definitely a Legion riff. So putting the Guardians there, that's what invites that comparison. We want to contrast it with the utopia, if I explain how we were thinking at the time. But Gerber's misanthropy aside, are there any sustained Marvel futures that are utopian? 2099 is a dark cyberpunk, Days of Future Past, you got Universe X, the Maestro stuff with the Hulk. I mean, none of that is utopian. So like in Star Trek, I think we hit the bottom before coming up again in the DC universe, but by the time we're in 1,000 years from now, depending on your version of Legion, of course, DC has gone brighter and Marvel has stayed darker.
The too long didn't read response is, thank you, Ward, for all of your praise. Rob McCarthy said, you gotta feel bad for the Guardians. Their world was taken over by aliens. The Silver Surfer thumped them in one issue. They fight for 5 years. Then the Thing and Cap show up. Bam, the war is over.
And let's end on Chris Franklin, our good friend. He says, fun show, gents. I had no idea that this was only their second appearance. Looks like Sal Buscema came up with their classic looks. I enjoyed the Jim Valentino series at the time and bought the first year or so of the series, but I barely recall anything about it. I know there was like a quest for the Captain America shield. That's what I remember.
Yeah, that came up later, yeah.
Thanks for teaming up with me, Ryan. We're at the end of the show. Tell people what you're working on at the moment.
You can still find me, as always, hosting Cheers Cast, coming out almost every Thursday, where I'm going through my favorite TV show of all time, Cheers. Just about done with season 6. I've also got a couple of recent episodes of Give Me Those Star Wars that's coming back, and I've got a few more episodes in the near future, hopefully, and also episodes of Fire and Water Records in various stages of pre-planning, because I hope to get one or two more episodes of that before the end of the year.
Oh, cool. Well, a reminder that we do have a Patreon, so if you like this content, want more like it, please think about making a monthly or one-time donation, the amount of which will allow you to unlock rewards. Check it out at patreon.com/FW podcast. This month, we're proud to team up with our sponsor, Alan W. Wright, the Bold Outlaw. We do enjoy reading your thoughts. Best place for that, fireandwaterpodcast.com. We'll read your comments on this issue when Ryan is back with us. But next month, I'll be here with Bass as we continue our coverage of DC Comics Presents with number 5. On that, see you next time for another amazing superhero team up, because after all, justice
is a team effort.